Hopefully, even though I'm a diplomat, I would love to hear some, whatever undiplomatic questions y'all have about this topic of the changing nature of global power by virtue of increasingly ubiquitous and powerful information networks. And in talking about that mouthful of a topic, I wanted to start off by talking about menstruating dairy cows in East Africa. Now, anybody who's ever worked for me knows that there is no idea too crazy to bring to me. I had this really smart young woman working for me named Alana Berkowitz, and she came to me one time and she said, "Alec, the way that we do development in sub-Saharan Africa is more often than not a white guy with a white shirt and a red tie from the United States flies to Africa, notices the problems there, diagnoses it, flies back to the United States, and builds a development project around it." She said, "I have a crazy idea." She said, "I want us to get involved in a program in which we would tap the apps developers and the techies in Tanzania, in Uganda, in Kenya, and throughout much of the rest of East Africa, convene them, bring them together with sort of a network of civil society organizations from throughout Africa. The civil society organizations are going to define the problems that they have, and the local African apps developers and technologists are going to develop solutions for it, and we're going to sponsor a contest to give cash prizes away to the technology developers who develop the products that solve these problems as identified by the African civil society organizations. And the winner of this first Apps for Africa contest was this crazy thing called iCow. And interestingly, iCow was identified by organizations from throughout East Africa that said, "Look, our economy is overwhelmingly impacted by the rise and fall of the subsistence level dairy farmer. And there are enormous inefficiencies within the life of the subsistence level dairy farmer because they all have access to very little information, and the information that they need to access changes quite often." And so what this Kenyan apps developer came up with was an SMS-based and voice-based app that in essence would connect subsistence level dairy farmers to real-time information that they need. So for example, previously it had been the case that, you know, if a Maasai dairy farmer wanted to sell one of his cows, he would have to take 3 days to walk 40 miles to a square of a village and hopefully sell one of his cows if there was somebody there willing to buy it. As part of this iCow app, this farmer is now able to pick up the phone and within 200 miles of him find out who is in the market for dairy cows and, you know, what they're offering. Also, one of the big things apparently that throttles back the level of productivity in East African dairy cow communities is understanding the dairy cycles and the breeding cycles. And so literally there are agriculture experts on the back end of this SMS-based and voice-based application that can help coach farmers through the process of knowing how and when to do milking cycles and how to increase the yield, how to increase the breeding yield of their cows. So literally you will send an SMS describing the menstrual cycles of your cows, and these ag experts will then guide you through how to increase the breeding yields. Let me tell you, this is not something that the white guy with the white shirt and the red tie in Washington would have come up with. And there are all sorts of conclusions that could be drawn by this through this crazy little contest and the fact that now thousands and thousands and thousands of farmers in Africa are using it. But the thing that I would draw out of this of greatest importance actually has to do with power. Now, power is a topic that is almost impolite to talk about aloud. But not surprisingly, working for Hillary Clinton and, you know, working across the hall from her, this is that which concerns our diplomats and our senior government officials most. It's power. It's accumulation, it's exercise, leveraging it for our diplomatic and development goals. And if somebody asked me what the one thing I've learned, the one thing I've learned in the last 3 years working for Hillary Clinton, is that there is a massive redistribution of power globally right now. And it is from hierarchies, like government, like the nation state. And that power is being redistributed from hierarchies to individuals and networks of individuals. And so thinking, for example, about this silly example with apps for Africa and the iCow application, as few as 5 years ago, that would have been impossible. It would have been impossible, first of all, because there wouldn't have been the basic wireless infrastructure in rural East Africa. But it also wouldn't have been possible because to develop one of those applications, to market and other such things, would have required the support of hierarchies. It would have required the backing and support of the telecommunications company. It would have taken a marketing firm to do place-based marketing for the purposes of dissemination. And that's simply not necessary anymore. Processing and distribution power have evolved from hierarchies to individuals in ways that weren't previously possible. And traditional top-down methods of exercising power have completely splintered. And this is something that trends back literally to the birth of the internet, but I would argue that we've hit sort of the tipping point for this in literally just the last 24 months. It's really just in the last 24 months that access to these very powerful information networks has redistributed power in such a profound way. And it's absolutely throwing people at the top of governments, people at the top of big corporations, people at the top of these hierarchies, it's throwing them through a loop completely. And we see evidence of this time and time again. I want to give just a couple quick examples of some of the better known illustrations of this, and then talk about what I think it means for the future. So there's been a lot of commentary about what technology and what social media did or did not do in the revolutions in the Middle East. If some people call them Twitter or Facebook revolutions or such things, I refuse to do that because I believe that to call something a Twitter revolution or a Facebook revolution suggests that people rebelled because of social media or that the revolutions were successful because of social media. I think that if you actually sort of scrape down and if you actually dig into the data and you talk to people who had their boots on the ground there, you see that what was really behind people rebelling were things like high food prices, corruption, disaffection with ruling families, a lack of economic opportunity and such things. But that technology and social media played, I think we can now say, four clear roles. Technology did four things in the context of these revolutions. Number one, it accelerated movement making. If you think about other movements, whether it was the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa or the democracy movements in East Europe in the 1970s and 1980s, more often than not, these were movements that were developed over a period of many years with institutions developed behind it and leaders developed behind it. And more often than not, people were meeting under cover of night in basements, and it involved very strong ties between them. One of the things that's been really interesting about these revolutions that we've seen is that the movement making itself has become wildly accelerated. So from the time that a fruit vendor named Mohamed Bouazizi literally lit himself on fire on December 17th of 2010 to the dictator, Ben Ali, getting on a Gulfstream and flying out of his country was 5 weeks. From the time of the protests in Tahrir Square to Hosni Mubarak being forced out of power was 4 weeks. And this is because of the relatively open platforms that are social media. Now, one of the downsides of this is that the fact that these platforms are so open and lend themselves to very fast movement making is, I can tell you, that it makes it all the easier now for intelligence and law enforcement services to infiltrate, monitor, and manipulate the content that's being done over these platforms, so that if a revolution isn't successful, then the governments that are being attacked are going to, or against whom revolution is being made are in uniquely strong positions to identify the sources of dissent. We saw this in Iran after the Green Movement there in June of 2009. So thing one, it accelerates movement making. Thing two is it helps make weak ties between people strong for the purposes of exercising dissent. So one of the really interesting thing for sort of geeky diplomats like me was to see what was it that brought together the 57-year-old member of the Muslim Brotherhood to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Nike-wearing, Sorbonne-educated 27-year-old digital hipster in Tahrir Square. Well, part of what the evidence now shows is that it was connections initially made online that helped bring together people offline. So weak ties can be made strong by virtue of connections initially made on the internet. Now, having said that, as we think about Egypt, for example, and the 57-year-old member of the Muslim Brotherhood being brought together with the 27-year-old Sorbonne-educated, Nike-wearing, secular Egyptian, I actually think that as we now pivot into elections and into governance, I think what we're going to see is the internet and social media specifically actually being used to draw people apart from each other. So if you think about the internet in a political context, including here in the United States, what tends to happen is voices at the edge become amplified. So whether it's with the Tea Party on the right or with the Netroots on the left, it's voices at the edges that tend to be empowered politically within movement making. And so even though these tools were great bringing people together who were not like each other or who did not like each other for the purposes of exercising dissent, once the revolution is over, unfortunately part of what we're seeing is that that social media and technology specifically are being used to pull people apart again. The third thing I think that we've learned from these revolutions about the role of technology and social media is that it wildly enriches the information environment. And in for an audience like this that's very sophisticated about information, where you're getting your information from hundreds if not thousands of sources across half a dozen platforms, half a dozen devices and what have you, this might be surprising. But in many of these countries, as recently as 3 years ago, 4 years ago, people were still getting all of their information from that one newspaper they read in the morning, or that one state-controlled broadcast newscast they watched on their TV at night. And so what's interesting is the fact that connectivity has so accelerated in the last 3 or 4 years in the Middle East, in the developing world, is it has completely obliterated the concept of state control of information. So in Tunisia, for example, in 2008 was not that long ago. In 2008, there were 28,000 Facebook accounts. So basically the sons and daughters of the elite. 2 years later, just 2 years later, 2010, there were 1.4 million. So from 28,000 to 1.4 million, which is about 18% of the population. And what this means is that the information environment, people's access to information, went through the roof. And instead of being dependent on the newspaper you read in the morning or the state-controlled news broadcast you watch at night, people were getting their information through citizen journalists like this guy, who would be able to self-publish what was happening. And then the fourth thing we know from these revolutions and how it's changing power globally is we now see more often than not leaderless movement making. We have diplomats running all over North Africa looking for Nelson Mandela, looking for Thomas Jefferson, looking for Vaclav Havel, looking for Lech Walesa. They are not going to find him. So one of the, I guess you could almost say, negative things about this wildly accelerated calendar for movement building is that leaders don't develop, and particularly not leaders around whom a whole country will then galvanize, like Nelson Mandela in South Africa, like Lech Walesa in Poland, like Vaclav Havel in Czechoslovakia. And so when, you know, my colleagues from the State Department, you know, touch down in Cairo and say, all right, who's in charge here? There's no one person in charge. Leadership has become networked. it has become nodal. So these are almost, they are not leaderless revolutions, but the leadership itself is largely networked. This has not been a dynamic that's been exclusive to the Middle East. We also saw this in the country that puts the most resources into controlling its information environment. In China, the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese government spends literally billions of dollars to censor and try to control the internet. They employ tens of thousands of people whose job it is just to control the content that is there. One time I made the Chinese government mad, one of the many times. And if you had searched for me on Chinese search engines, there were 3 million results. And then one day it went from 3 million to zero. 3 million to zero in one day, because the Chinese decided that I was problematic, so they're like, we're gonna wipe you off the internet. One thing that was really interesting was there was a train crash in July of last year in Wenzhou province, and 40-some people died, just short of 200 people were hurt. And the response from the Chinese government was that which it typically is. Let's blame Western technology. Let's issue talking points that all of the media publish about what happened. You know, let's make sure that nobody from government can be blamed for this. And what's interesting is on the microblogging platform in China, this thing called Xina Weibo, tons of people who are actually on the train or saw the train crash actually posted on Xina Weibo and said essentially, that's nonsense. I was there and this is what happened. And what then happened is 26 million posts were posted over the next 10 days. And the Chinese government was so overwhelmed by the pushback in this domain that they had to, what they had done there is they had actually buried those train cars. They'd literally dug holes and took those big train cars and dug and buried them in the ground. Closed the investigation. They had said, all right, this is what happened. Because of millions of people publishing 26 million comments on Xina Weibo, they literally dug up the train cars, reopened an investigation, started firing people. And the first time I can ever think of, they actually changed their story in official media outlets. So what's interesting is you can take one person, me, and say, all right, you may appear 3 million times, but guess what, you're gone now. But what you can't do is take millions of your citizens and say, all right, all millions of you now are gone. So this is a fascinating shift in power. It's a shift in power again to networks and networks of citizens. Now, lest anybody think that this is, you know, sort of an American finger wagging at the rest of the world. Oh, look what's happening in the Middle East. Oh, look what's happening in China. This is also happening in the United States. And, you know, one example that I'll point to is with SOPA and PIPA. And, you know, a couple pieces, if you aren't familiar with it, a couple pieces of online piracy legislation that were proposed in the United States Congress. Now, SOPA and PIPA, which, you know, the short version of it is, you know, the copyright holders wanted to mess with how the internet works to basically be able to protect their intellectual property. That's the short version of it. Anyway, it started off as a sort of traditional Washington fight. Southern California versus Northern California. The copyright holders and the content guys versus the internet companies, the platform companies. You know, they hire up their lobbyists and they start exercising power in sort of the good old-fashioned traditional Washington way. What's really interesting then, though, is that even though this was a fairly obscure piece of online piracy legislation that was still in committee in the House of Representatives and in the United States Senate, American citizens themselves became educated about the content of SOPA and PIPA, and people who have absolutely nothing to do with traditional power structures in Washington organized themselves against these two pieces of legislation. And as witness to this, it was really fascinating and, to be blunt, fun for me to watch the response from traditional members of sort of the government hierarchies respond to this. I can't tell you how many times people who were very, very powerful in government would tell the stories saying, you know what, as long as I've been in positions of power, my kids have never talked to me about what I've done, what I do for a living. But my 17-year-old confronted me at breakfast this morning about some piece of online piracy legislation. What the hell is going on? And this happened time and time again throughout Washington as this, as these pieces of online piracy legislation were being discussed. And basically because of this citizen-centered dynamic, even though companies like Wikipedia and Google and others got involved, the real power came from citizens. What's fascinating is that it completely changed the power dynamic in Washington. Millions of people who could not and would not hire lobbyists, millions of people who may or may not know how a bill becomes a law, completely changed the course of this piece of legislation in Washington. So this is not something that's happening in the Middle East and China, and the United States can sort of stand up and sort of bemusedly look at what's going on. This is something that's happening in, you know, 192 or 193 of the 195 countries on planet Earth. And in the face of this, what happens is that the hierarchies, government, big institutions and others, they feel overwhelmed. They feel an extraordinary loss of control, and this loss of control is real. The 21st century is a lousy time to be a control freak. And government is having to contend with this loss of control. But people who think that this is just about the internet, I would actually argue that whenever government faces a loss of control, it always fights back. Hierarchies always fight back. I mean, the printing press was invented in, I think, 1441. And for almost 200 years following the invention of the printing press, government essentially litigated against its use. So as late as the 17th century, the only way in which you could legally print a book in England, was you would have to get a license from one of 10 people, you know, like the Queen or the Archbishop of Canterbury or people like this. And as recent as the 17th century in England, 200 years after the invention of the printing press, if you published a book that didn't have a license, you would get your face branded, literally, with an S and a D for sedition. I can give you 10 more examples, but basically whenever power goes directly to citizens at the expense of a nation state, especially power that relates to the ability to publish and distribute information, there is a backlash. And the test of a government's character, the test of any hierarchy's character, is going to be how it responds. Now, we've seen some of the responses lately from the Middle East. As it relates to the internet. It is now on page one of the How to Be a Dictator's Handbook that if your people rebel, look out for the internet. So it's interesting, in the first of the Arab Spring revolutions, Ben Ali, I talked earlier about those 1.4 million citizens of Tunisia, the nearly 20% of Tunisia that used Facebook. The first action, one of the first actions taken by the Ben Ali government at the beginning of the revolution was they cyber attacked their citizens' Facebook accounts. And this is actually the first case of a break between the United States and the Ben Ali government. We demarched the Tunisian government, we sort of hauled them in, we fussed at them in Tunis and Washington, and they were actually absolutely stunned that we thought that this was a big deal. But they cyber attacked their citizens' Facebook accounts to try to find the leader. Who's behind this? In Egypt, the Mubarak government literally closed down the mobile and the mobile networks and the internet for like 5 days. And in so doing, he basically lost whatever support he had left among his people. In Libya, on the second day of the revolution, number two, Mohammed al-Qaddafi, oldest son of Muammar al-Qaddafi, he's the chairman of Libyatel. Second day of the revolution, he turned off all the networks. No more internet, no more cell phones, no more landline phones. So page one on How to Be a Dictator's Handbook is shut off the internet in times of dissent. Now, page two of the How to Be a Dictator's Internet says that in times of peace, surveil the heck out of your people. So one of the what I consider to be one of the very, very negative consequences of the citizen-centered movements that have taken root in the Middle East is that governments all around the world are scared to death of their newly empowered citizens. And what we are seeing is massive, and by massive I mean tens of billions of dollars of investment in incredibly sophisticated networking technologies that allow governments to intercept their citizens' communications and move to an environment of total information awareness. If you think back to some of the movies you've seen where, you know, somebody and some intelligence agency is using pretty cool technology to see what's going on in the world, and you think that that's pretty fantastic and far-fetched technology, it's not. And in fact, the technologies that are in place and they're being used are actually far more sophisticated than you can imagine, and they're growing more sophisticated because there's so much investment in it. And frankly, a lot of American and European companies are benefiting from the increased sales to authoritarian countries who are significantly investing in these regimes. So with all of the empowerment that comes from networking technologies, one of the things that we have to remember is that even though I believe it empowers citizens and networks of citizens at the expense of governments, at the expense of the nation state, we ought not think that that is an absolute transfer of power. That point, in fact, governments will rebel against this transfer of power, and one of the things that they have at their disposal is the ability to invest in significant tools of surveillance. And I think that this is an area that everyday citizens need to become smarter about, because the consequences for all of our lives are only going to grow over the next 2, 3, 4 years as the technologies become more sophisticated and the build-outs take place. So let me close by talking about change. So, you know, as I said earlier, if there's one thing that I've learned in 3 years, it's that there's a massive redistribution of geopolitical power. It's not on a geographic basis. It's not from west to east, from Europe and the United States to Asia. It's not from the global north to the global south. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. The degree to which that's true, I won't speculate. What I do know, the far greater transfer of power that's taking place right now is from hierarchies to citizens and networks of citizens. We are in an environment of absolutely spectacular change and a remarkable loss of control. And it's in the face of this change that governments will really find their character. And if there's one thing that, one piece of advice that I give to foreign ministers, prime ministers, what have you, it's that it's a hybridization of something that Darwin said, a bastardization of something that Darwin said, which is that it's not the strongest of the species that survive, nor the most intelligent, but that most adaptable to change. It's not the strongest of the species that survive, nor the most intelligent, but that most adaptable to change. So with that, I'll thank you, and I'd invite any questions you have. Thank you. So I think they want you to use the microphone, so if you want to just queue up behind the microphone, by all means. And again, even though I'm a diplomat, feel free to ask undiplomatic questions. If it's too hard a question, I'll just dodge it like a good government bureaucrat. Yes.
Hi, do I need to introduce myself? Or my name is Henrik Funds, I'm a Danish reporter. I was wondering, when you talk about this to Hillary Clinton, how do you fit WikiLeaks into this perspective?
Sure. So if you didn't hear him, his question was about WikiLeaks and how do you fit WikiLeaks into all of this. Look, I think that WikiLeaks is a proof point for all of this. If you think about the WikiLeaks organization would not have been physically possible 10 or 15 years ago. The combination of processing power plus bandwidth available at the desktop of a 22-year-old Army private would have been insufficient to download 252,000 alleged cables. Further, the very existence of the WikiLeaks organization, which is largely made up of members and followers instead of paid staff, and a web address instead of a street address, which is truly transnational and networked in nature, is a dynamic I think that is very much of the day and which would not have been physically possible 10 or 12 years ago. So I actually see WikiLeaks as a proof point for all of us.
Which countries do you feel have the most citizen-positive and flexible digital policies?
So her question was, which countries do I think have the basically the best digital policies? Well, number one is Estonia. This place is bananas. So Estonia, basically, they have in 1991, Estonia had red lines. The GDP, the per capita GDP in Belarus and Estonia immediately after the fall of the Berlin Wall were roughly equivalent, very, very poor. And what the people, and what the leaders of Estonia did is they said, we are going to go from being Estonia to Estonia. We're going to make a big bet on trying to position our country to compete and succeed in the knowledge-based economy. And so what they've done is spectacular. I mean, basically all of the things that sound purely aspirational to us in terms of electronic medical records, online voting, all of these sorts of things that they've basically been done there. So I think if I were to sort of overgeneralize, I would say the Scandinavian countries and some of the Baltic countries, I think, are doing the best job. If I were to broaden that out a little bit geographically, I also think that there are promising, I also think that there's a lot of promise in some of what's being done in South America. In Chile, for example, I think that, you know, Chile has positioned itself very intelligently vis-a-vis its sort of competitors and neighbors by virtue of how they have positioned themselves. And then, frankly, the United States, even though we've got a long way to go, you know, this president has said, let's make mistakes of commission rather than omission when it comes to digitizing citizen services. This morning, a buddy of mine was named White House CTO, a guy named Todd Park. And the stuff that he did with health-related data would have been unimaginable a couple years ago. So I think that the United States is punching up above its weight, even though we have a long way to go. But the people doing it the best are in Scandinavia and the Baltics. Yes, sir.
Hey, Alec. Craig Aaron from Free Press. My question for you is, you mentioned that there are a lot of U.S. companies that are making a lot of money selling surveillance technologies and other things to repressive regimes. Are there things we could or should be doing domestically, either in terms of activism or in terms of policy, to help name and shame these companies or to help make sure that the U.S. is leading by example and living up to what it's, you know, telling the rest of the world they should do?
Right. Yeah, so there are basically three tools for throttling back the sales of technologies to regimes who are going to use it to oppress their people. Number one is sanctions. Number two are export controls. And number three is pressure. And all three have their uses. So, you know, we've extended sanctions and worked with the Europeans to extend sanctions so that it forbids sales to certain countries. So the, you know, what happened in part with Syria, for example, is we had sanctions in place. We had sanctions in place, but the Europeans did not, and it didn't end up mattering because whatever they wanted from us, they could just buy from Italy. So, for example, in Italy, they, you know, bought gear from Aeria Spa, which was, you know, pretty sophisticated. Export controls are also a tool, and, you know, I work closely with your former colleague Ben Scott to strengthen export controls. But then thirdly, it's public pressure. And so absent law, you know, Alec Ross cannot just sit here and sort of say, you get to sell this and you get to sell that, but you don't get to sell that. You know, there has to be a legal framework for it. But because the technologies are so fast changing, government export controls and sanctions oftentimes haven't caught up with the law. So sure, I absolutely think there's an advocacy piece here. What I will say though is that sanctions waivers can actually be used to our advantage as well. You know, one of the things that my team did since I've been in place is we actually created a category for sanctions waivers, where before we just said, you know, you couldn't bring technologies into a country, but we created sanctions waivers for, quote, mass market downloadable software, so that activists in Iran, in Syria, and elsewhere can get sanctioned. We can provide sanctions waivers for certain kinds of technologies that we actually want the activists to be able to use to be able to stay safe. Yeah.
Could you give us one or two examples of how the U.S. government, I think, is using technology in an interesting way with these global networks, with whether it's the Secretary's office or the CTO's office, internal, external, ways that you think are interesting and sort of that we might find?
Sure. So I'll give you two examples of sort of interesting use of technology on our part. One is, over the last 3 years, we've spent about $70 million on the development of technologies that will basically allow the, I think the diplomatic way of saying this is allowing people to exercise their universal rights. What this means is that we work cooperatively with computer science departments and other partners to be able to develop technologies that allow people to get around a censored internet and stay safe in so doing. One example of it is, if you saw the New York Times article, "The Internet in a Suitcase," it's an interesting article. You ought to read about it. It's this little, it's almost like an Ocean's 11-like gang of hackers that we put together to develop a bandwidth solution when governments are trying to throttle down access to bandwidth. Another example, which grew in part out of the failed green movement in Iran, one of the things that we saw was that when activists were arrested, one of the first things that would happen is their cell phones would be taken from them. And then their address book, their text messages, their emails. This was like a guidebook, you know, for the intelligence services or for law enforcement agencies. It was like, well, here's the dissent movement in this person's address book. And so one of the things that we supported was a panic button, so that if you're being taken down by the Mukhabarat, if you're being taken down by the secret police, you can literally just key in a quick code, and it acts as a panic button. It wipes your address book and wipes your communications in a way in which it's not retrievable if you are in the custody of the secret police. But it also sends out a distress signal to sort of a pre-identified network of people who you would want to know that you're being taken down by the secret police. So the internet in a suitcase and the panic button are two examples of about a dozen that we've supported. The other 10 or so I can't talk about. In terms of a cool innovation coming out of the White House, the most important thing that the White House has done in this domain, in my opinion, is changing the, and this is a big deal, it's changing the default setting for data from closed to open. It's basically giving citizens access to all of our data, whether it's health-related data, Veterans Administration data, or what have you, and basically saying, here it is in machine-readable format, you guys do whatever you want with it. And this is really good because, frankly, I think the innovations around open data are not going to come from government. They're going to come from people like you who know what to do with that data. And so by changing the default setting for data from closed to open, and allowing you to do whatever you want with it, I think that this has very positive spillover effects.
So you work in a State Department that's very pro-women and empowering women and girls, particularly in the developing world. And I'm curious to know if there's anything similar to the iCal app that you described at the beginning of your talk that's being used specifically in this realm of empowering women and girls in the developing world.
Yeah, so one of the cool things is I've spent, you know, a lot of the last 15 years sort of among the digerati, and it's overwhelmingly male, but it's not at the State Department. You know, it's one of the things that Hillary Clinton has done very well, which is that she brings a strong gender focus to it. A couple hours ago, she actually gave an award to a woman named Leela Jana from Samasource, for innovations in empowering women and girls. So there have been a couple things that we've done here. First thing we've done is we've launched an initiative called M Women. There's about a 300 million person gap between the raw number of men who have access to mobiles and women. 300 million more men have access to mobiles than women. And so we've launched this initiative with the Cherie Blair Foundation and others, basically to try to cut that 300 million to 150 million. And the way to do it is to work with the GSMA providers, to work with the big telecoms, and get them, frankly, to adapt some of their market offerings and skew them in ways that will lend themselves to adoption by women. And so first, it's sort of the infrastructure layer. The first thing that you have to make sure is that women actually have access to the tools. And then in terms of, you know, apps for Africa-like developments, apps for Africa-like tools, you know, we've supported the development of several dozen of these, we've supported the development of about a dozen or so of these contests, and certain of them have been focused exclusively on women and gender rights. And then lastly, we do this thing called technology delegations, where we try to bring some of America's rock star technologists and bring them into a country to help develop local solutions. And we did an all-women's tech delegation to Sierra Leone and Liberia. So, you know, look, to work at the State Department means you're working on women's issues. And that is as it should be.
Hello. I'm actually representing Startup Chile. It is a Chilean, it's a program from the Chilean government. So we have in our strategy, social media is essential to attract high potential entrepreneurs. So I would like to know your opinion about government using social media to achieve governmental objectives.
Yeah, I'm gonna take a second to brag for a second. I mean, look, the White House, in my opinion, does a better job. Of the 195 countries on planet Earth, I think the White House right now is demonstrating how to use social media. So their head of new media, Macon Phillips, and his team are doing, I think, incredibly interesting things as a way of connecting the governing to the governed. And so by taking our vaunted public sector institutions, but using social media as a way of connecting the governing to the governed, I think is one of the most powerful and important things that can be done in this domain. The White House is doing a great job of it. Pablo Matamoros in Chile is doing a very good job of it. The most important thing here, I believe, is a change in attitude. And so you have to have people in power at the top of these governments willing to give up control. Remember, I was talking about control before. So at the White House, what they've clearly illustrated is that you don't have to just be standing behind the podium to get official communications out. Rather, we can use social media as a way, as sort of the front door for communicating and engaging with people.
Hi, just wondering your take on the Kony 2012 stuff that's been emerging.
Yeah, so she was asking about Kony 2012. So I haven't actually watched the tape yet. I haven't actually had the half an hour yet to watch it. I will say that there's some, my impression, and this is an underinformed impression, is that there's been both good and bad. On the one hand, I think that it's fantastic that awareness of the atrocities of Joseph Kony have been elevated. You know, this is something, you know, I spent a lot of my own time focusing on issues in East Africa. He's an evil man. And the president last year, you know, sent to some controversy 100 special forces in to assist with the takedown of Joseph Kony. So the raising of awareness is a good thing. The one thing that bugs me is I wish that they had a little bit more accuracy in terms of the content. And again, I haven't seen it, but you know, that's sort of the gut reaction from us is just that, you know, it would have been so much better if there had just been, you know, a little bit better fact check on some of it, or if some of the content itself was a little bit more current. But, you know, net-net, I think it's positive. Net-net, I think it's positive. Hi. I think I've got time for the questions for the people who are standing in line. Yes.
So in traditional diplomacy, discretion is a key to success generally. But in an age of social media, where people are throwing everything out there publicly, that's maybe no longer the case, one could argue. Can you talk about American strategies of reconciling this openness with the traditional diplomacy, but also possibly how more subversive governments or governments that are not necessarily on the most friendly terms with the U.S. are doing the same?
Yeah, so, I mean, the first thing is we just don't share everything. You know, I mean, so, you know, there is still necessary secrecy in government. And so what we've done is we've tried to be increasingly open while recognizing that there is still necessary discretion. And so what you don't see is you don't see a bilateral engagement between Secretary Clinton and a foreign minister being live tweeted. You know, that yet hasn't happened. So it's an opening, and I think it's been a substantial opening, but it hasn't been a total opening. I mean, I don't think any of us believe that there ought to be webcams in our offices. You know, look, I'm as close to the edge as anybody at the State Department in this domain, and I sure as heck wouldn't want that. And I think that our effectiveness would be significantly reduced if that were the case. So the key, again, is what is the default setting? Is the default setting closed, or is the default setting open? Where historically, within the diplomatic realm, the default setting has been closed, it's to try to move it toward being open. I would be lying right now if I said, oh, the default setting is open. You know, unless something is classified, it's going to be available for public consumption. We are absolutely not at that point yet. But I think moving towards a posture where everything is implicitly secret to everything is implicitly open is a good thing. In terms of how more restrictive countries are dealing with this, I mean, they are, I think they're really turned inside out by it. You know, I think that they're extremely threatened by it. And we do see certain cases like, you know, Hugo Chavez tweeting, or, you know, the spokesman for Al-Shabaab using social media or other such things. So part of their response has been, when they see its power, they choose to selectively engage. But I think the overwhelmingly the response is one of fear, and one that's, frankly, is almost angry, some of what I've encountered.
Thank you.
Two more questions.
Hi, Alec. Thanks for coming today. It seems like the big explosion of social media and citizen technology in the past year has been used primarily reactively to the governments, Tunisia, Syria, elsewhere, food prices, corruption, arrests. And it's a very good use of it, and it's the first time being used for a lot of these citizens. But the longer term and sustainable use of that technology for education, learning democracy, learning after decades and decades of authoritarian rule. So how can we support that longer term use of technology for those type of things when it's often the type that's monitored the most by these governments and they try to repress it?
Yeah, look, if there were no revolutions, this is what I would work on. You know, technology for empowerment, I think, is what all of you should, you know, to the extent that you want to be able to give back and to the extent that you have aptitudes working in this domain, there are a variety of areas where I believe that the killer app has not been developed yet. We've seen some promise with English language learning and some other things, but I have yet to see the software or the app that unleashes primary education in historically poor or historically isolated communities. So there are entire sectors, and the big three for me in this domain are education, financial services, and health, where those three areas have more to do with people's well-being than just about anything else in their life, and all three of them are rife for disruption. And any of the three of them could be significantly disrupted by relatively low cost to produce tools, applications, or other such things. But I would just look at these three jumbo decabillion-dollar market segments as areas where if you can make some significant kind of disruption, and it can be a pro-market disruption, it does not have to be something philanthropic in nature, that can do more to unleash the well-being of people living in poverty than anything else. If you look at mobile finance, mobile banking, let's go back to my first slide from Kenya. The M-Pesa program in Kenya, I think, is now being used by more than a third of the population of Kenya. If you want to get a cab in Nairobi and you want to pay cash, the cabbie's going to be annoyed with you because he wants to be paid by mobile phone. And the data now shows that the average increase in household income by virtue of people having adopted mobile payments is between 5 and 30%. That's a big deal. And so financial services, health, and education, those are the three areas to develop products and services.
Hi, thanks for coming today. Could you speak a bit about your vision for hierarchies or your vision for government, and also maybe if you think those are the same?
Sure.
I know it's a broad...
I don't know how appropriate it is for me to talk about my vision for hierarchies or my vision for government. I think that's above my pay grade.
Please do.
No, but what I do believe is going back to what I said at the end, which is that it's not the strongest of the species that survive, nor the most intelligent, but that most adaptable to change. So the most appropriate thing now for government, for hierarchies, is to make the necessary changes to pivot to where its citizens are. So thinking, for example, about the actions by our White House, moving the default setting for our data from closed to open is an important adaptation. It's not to fight against its citizens' desire to control its own data, its own information. It's not saying, oh, well, we, the white shirt, red tie bureaucrats, know what's best for you. It's to give up some of that control and allow our citizens to productively engage in these spaces. So I think that intelligently giving up control, intelligently and productively engaging citizens in their own well-being is that which the best hierarchies and the best governments will do. I mean, we also see this within the private sector, within traditional marketplaces. Even very big companies that can really invest their consumer base in product development or other such things, they can learn how to iterate with citizens as they develop what's next, are outperforming. They're outperforming those who don't. Now, there are well-known exceptions to this, the sort of Steve Jobs model of closed sort of genius inspiration. But there are not very many Steve Jobses out there. And so absent sort of the spectacular Jobs-like genius, a process of iteration between the hierarchy and its constituents is going to make for a better product or service. With that, thank you very much.